It's a great privilege to introduce Kester Bruin to everyone. Kester is a teacher, writer, author, active tweeter. He has a passion for professional and competitive croquet as well, I hear. Maybe he'll talk about that later. But one thing I'd like to recommend is his latest book, which is Mutiny, Why We Love Pirates and How They Can Save Us, which is in the bookstore at Greenbelt. So we just wanted to make sure that you'd seen that that's coming out. He was going to talk a bit, and you have one there. So give a very dry, warm Greenbelt welcome to Kester Bruin.
Jesus reigns. Yeah. Boom, boom. It is the way I tell him, yeah, thank you. If any of you are over there want to come over this way, it's dry and it's warm and we're having a wonderful time and we're going to talk about pirates. And yes, I've got this book, Mutiny, out. There's actually something very, very special for you here today. I've got a few limited edition copies of some hand-printed hardbacks that I've done as well, which will be available. I'm signing a few books in the bookshop afterwards, so you can come over that. And then after that, you're all invited to my 40th birthday party. I was 40 the other day. And someone from Esther, who's a friend on Facebook, brought me a present all the way from, well, not all the way from Germany, but she's from Germany and she's here. So thank you, Esther. I've been given a little present today, which I'm really, really happy about. What I'm going to try and do today is to talk a little bit about pirates in general, in different circumstances. But what I particularly want to focus on is one part of the book, towards the end of the book, where I look at what pirates might signify in terms of a kind of more deeper psychological level and what pirates might do for us as people of faith about, you know, what signifies, what significance they might have for us. And in particular, to retell the story of the prodigal son as a tragedy, which I think one person said that was worth the price of the book alone. And you're getting it in a talk, so you should buy the book anyway afterwards, just for the hell of it. On the 10th of February, 1722, the Welsh pirate Captain Roberts, and I'm not going to do a Cornish accent all the way through, but there'll be a little bit of Cornish occasionally. He breakfasted on a dish called Solomon Gundy, which is a stew of meat, eggs, herring, wine, pickles, vinegar. Sounds completely delicious. Having breakfasted on that, he did up his crimson waistcoat, put on his beautiful gold necklace with a diamond cross, and probably reflected that he was about to die, basically because he'd screwed up. And the reason he screwed up was this, is that his crew had told him that they'd spotted a British naval vessel rounding the Cape, and he'd not believed them. He told them, oh, it's probably just another one of our ships bringing back some more booty. But actually, he was wrong. And this British naval vessel, the Swallow, was perhaps the most powerful warship of its day. 50 cannons spread over a number of decks, 3 masts, 200 feet long. This was a beast of a ship. But Roberts knew that his men would rather burn than see him die, because Roberts was one of the good guys. Roberts amassed his crew under what he called the Pirate Code. And this 11-point code meant that there was no fighting allowed on board. They had to have lights out at a particularly civil time. And all the men were allowed to share in the good food. All the men were allowed to share in the booty equally. So it was a very, very good life for them. A very, very good life for them on board Captain Roberts' vessels. But he was hated and despised by the British. Pirates were called villains of all nations. Everybody hated them. Absolutely everybody hated them. And a pirate or a sailor who turned pirate lasted on average less than 2 years before they were killed in a brutal, torturous, the most horrible way we can imagine fashion. They were strung up, they were drawn, they were quartered, their guts were spilled out and their bodies were put in caskets around the docks on the Thames just to make sure that no one else would turn pirate. So Captain Roberts, he got himself dressed and he barked his orders to his men, trying to lift them with a daring plan to close down the British vessel, the Swallow. They approached and they took the men of war's fire. They hoisted their black flag, the Jolly Roger, which the full Jolly Roger is a skeleton holding a rod of flames. And they returned their fire, packing all of the sail that they could in order to run by the Swallow and then head round while she sank. But the wind shifted. They lost steerage. The Swallow came round a second time. Sir Roberts got on deck, ready to fight. But the gunners of the Swallow fired a load of grape shot, a little ball full of pellets of lead. And that scattered and hit him in the throat. So knowing that death was certainly going to be upon him, he settled down, or collapsed down on the gun tackles, and lay down to die. His helmsman saw a man lying down and went to berate him for laziness or cowardice, but on seeing it was Roberts, he broke down in tears, crying out that he wished that the next shot would take him instead. Here was his captain dying, the captain who had told those who dared to ask that in honest naval service there is thin commons, low wages and hard labour, but in this pirate life there is plenty, pleasure, ease, liberty and power. They had all come the same way, Robert's crew, escaping the brutal slavery of the merchant navies for the democratic and free life of pirates, men who swore allegiance to no king and to no country, but only to fight for one another. Who would not balance creditor on this side, Roberts had said, when all that hazard is run for it, at worst is only a sour look or two at a choking. Grape shot in the throat or a rope around the neck. Roberts knew the risks he was taking. A merry life, but a short one, was his motto. And perhaps, choking up those words again as the blood spilled from his lacerated throat, hardly showing on the crimson waistcoat and breeches, but running red into the spray-washed deck, to the sound of booming cannon, came the falling masts and the approach of the British Navy. That's what we often think about when we think about pirates, these proper swashbuckling Caribbean pirates. And yet, the pirate spirit has infected everything. Pirate jokes. Anyone got a good pirate joke? I'll tell you an old pirate joke. You've all heard this one, but how much do pirates pay to get their ears pierced? A buck an ear. I can't even hear you laughing. Yeah, rim shot, you know. Pirate birthday parties. My son, who's around somewhere, has been invited to loads of pirate birthday parties. Not so many aggravated robbery ones, but plenty of pirate ones. Pirate clothing, pirate as a language on Facebook. Has anyone ever clicked that? International Talk Like a Pirate Day, which is coming up sometime in September or October. We're obsessed with pirates. And that obsession began to fascinate me. You know, where did it come from? What did it all mean? Well, the word pirate comes from a Greek word meaning basically to have a go, to make an attempt. And pirates were really have-a-go heroes, really. But what was it they were trying to have a go at? Well, pretty much everything now. You have pirate radio, pirate DVDs, pirate software, pirated books. The Pirate Party in Sweden has, I think, two members of the European Parliament now. There are pirates in Somalia, of course, Pirates of the Caribbean, one of the most successful franchises ever. So what possibly could all of these pirates have in common? Well, the kind of deeper connections between all of these different sorts of piracy I try and explore in the book. And I haven't got time to go all through the whole of that now, but the kind of summary I will say is this, that pirates emerge whenever something that is held in common is enclosed. In other words, it's taken from common ownership into private ownership. Pirates rise up whenever the commons is under threat. And perhaps it's easiest to think of that in terms of land. And as I'm sure you know, most of the land in England historically used to be worked in common. People from villages worked that together in common. And there used to be an ancient ritual, which I think is ripe for resurrection now, the ancient ritual of beating the bounds, whereby members of the parish would go around and they'd drink beer and eat cakes and basically smash down any fences that they found that blocked access to common land. And it was a way of educating the young people of the parish of the extent of the common lands that they worked together, the lands that, you know, supplied their food. But What happened is the land, you know, the kind of rich people there, the landowners, they actually started to enclose the common land, which was against the law, but they tried to get the law changed, and they succeeded in many cases, and they enclosed the land, threw the people off the common land, enclosed it and worked it for their own private profits. And the land enclosures is one of the great, I suppose, tragedies in one way of English history. It's certainly, you know, if you go up to the Highlands of Scotland too, I remember speaking to someone looking over from the Isle of Iona onto Mull at these beautiful lands, you know, wonderful, vast, open spaces. And he said, well, they're not meant to be like that. They're only like that because, you know, they chopped all the crofters off. This was land that was meant to be worked intensively, but it's not. It's now just in private feudal ownership. So these kind of beautiful open spaces are actually often tragic places because communities have been thrown off them. So the land in which many people, a community, had shared rights and thus shared responsibilities, were enclosed so that any one person had rights on that land. And that really pissed a lot of people off. you get things like the Midlands Revolt hundreds of years ago, and a guy called Captain Pouch, and he was called Captain Pouch, not because of what you're thinking, because he had this little leather pouch in which he claimed he kept a secret substance which would ward off any of the landowners and keep everyone safe who fought with Captain Pouch. Well, very quickly he was killed, and they opened up the pouch and found there was just a hard piece of cheese in there, and that was it. But he kind of galvanized people together, and they fought against these private landowners, and hundreds of people were killed trying to preserve these commoners' rights. But in general, away from this idea of land, what I want to argue is that the principle of fighting against enclosure, of defending the right of access to what should be held in common, works its way right through all of the places where we see piracy occurring. So, for example, pirate radio. Well, back in the 1950s, before you had Radio 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, you had the BBC Light Service, and presumably the BBC Heavy Service. But the BBC Light Service played, you know, modern marching music, and for a couple of hours a week they would play popular music. Well, that just wasn't enough. People wanted their music played on, you know, what was the state-monopolised broadcasting service, but they wouldn't play it. So what happened is you had the pirate radio stations emerging off the coast of England, out of the jurisdiction of the British government, which they hated, and they tried desperately to change the law to capture these guys, but they couldn't. So you had pirate radio emerging to give people access to radio that was significant for them. And that's continued through, actually. It wasn't just back in the 50s and 60s, but, you know, through stations like Kiss FM, which is a pirate London-based dance music station trying to, you know, give people the music that they wanted. You know, they wanted black music on the radio so that people could hear it. You've got gay radio, loads of different sorts of radio that were pirate radio originally, because the standard official radio stations weren't playing what people needed. Well, you've got Somali piracy. Now, I appreciate that Somali piracy now is really kind of heavily involved in organized crime networks and, you know, is a pretty tawdry business, basically. But the original Somali pirates were basically fishermen. Fishermen who were unemployed. Why? Because European trawlers had been through their waters and emptied everything. They'd taken away all the fish. Toxic waste had been dumped there. So nothing lived at all. And all the while, they've got these huge container ships shipping billions of dollars of consumer goods through the Gulf of Aden, up through, you know, as a quick way round to Europe. And they're thinking, well, you know, why are we excluded from that? You're using our waters, bringing these billions of dollars worth of goods, and, well, we'll have a bit of that. And for them, it was a shore tax, basically. If you want to use our waters, you're going to pay something for it. And that's, you know, again, a restricted access thing, and they were trying to, you know, break open a bit of that wealth, basically. Well, what about the pirates of the Caribbean? You're the original pirates that you have in the 18th century, in the kind of golden age of piracy from about 1705 through to 1720s. Well, the commons in this case was the great commons of the New World. You had this enormous commons of the ocean and, you know, around to the Caribbean and into the Americas, and the empires of Spain and England were fighting horribly to try and enclose this commons. They wanted to own it because it was going to generate them a huge amount of money. And they waged these bloody battles. They sent their navies out there. And both nations sent their navies to thieve off one another. Everybody was doing it. The Spanish were thieving off the British were thieving off the Spanish and off the Portuguese. Everybody is, you know, smashing into each other's vessels and taking what they could. So these boats, these Royal Naval vessels, have been crewed by men who were brutalized. I mean, it's the worst conditions you can imagine. They were worked incredibly hard. Injury was very, very common. The conditions were awful. And they were working to make their masters insanely rich. And yet they were paid nothing. The labor that they put into this, actually, they got nothing in return. They were excluded from the riches. So their turn to piracy was really no more than really a stepping out from under these oppressive conditions and taking charge of their own destiny. They did exactly what they had been trained to do all along. They thieved off other vessels. Now, it wasn't the thievery that the king was really hacked off about. It was the fact that he wasn't benefiting from it. The thievery was just the same. They just did what they were trained to do. These are guys who were ripped from the streets of London and other cities, taken away from their families, forced to work on these boats. So they went off and they did it for themselves. So the turn to piracy, in this case, is really a statement of independence. It's standing up and refusing to be cowed by the whips and chains of the merchants and princes. It's about refusing to continue to live as a slave and determining to live as a free person. Now, it's not well known that pirates actually would sail and attack slave ships as well. And in attacking the slave ships, they'd give them two options. They'd say, you can either come and join us as pirates, or we'll set you free. Which do you want to do? So there was an empathy and understanding that actually slavery was completely wrong, and the pirate, the way that the pirates organized themselves in highly democratic structures where the officers were elected and the income multiples in terms of sharing out the booty, well, the captain took the most risk. He got two shares. Even the lowest of the crew got one share. Now, if you can find me a company these days where the difference in income between the person at the top and the person at the bottom is only a factor of two, quite incredible. Quite incredible. Pirates, then, are not really about plunder and thievery and violence. The world in which they lived was about these things, and they were a part of that world. But pirates signify a move from oppression to freedom, a move to stand up and refuse the labels that the rich and powerful handed down to them. Piracy is about self-determination, the determination to be someone, regardless of how quickly that life might then be extinguished. Now, that's all very interesting from a historical and a social perspective, and the significance to stuff like the Occupy movement and so on, and the business of reforming capitalism and banking and so on. You know, those are areas I try and look at in the book to kind of think about what does piracy mean in terms of those sort of material structures. But what I want to focus on today, particularly just for this talk, is to think about the internal significance, not just the external one. So we're not talking now about the enclosure of material goods or cultural expressions, but perhaps what might be called the existential alienation. Our experiences of family, relationships, labour and culture may have left us, as Michael Houellebecq put it, as atomised, feeling that we lack some kind of integration. So if pirates can do some kind of work of unblocking, some kind of work smashing down these enclosures in the material world, can they do so in the inner world too? And my contention is that yes, they can. There are two examples I want to give you. One from the story of Peter Pan, and the other from the story of Star Wars. Any Star Wars geeks there? And me not. So you're probably going to get people coming to me afterwards saying, you know, I was a little bit wrong on, you know, this, but stick with it anyway. So first of all, Peter Pan. So the story of Peter Pan is of Wendy and her brothers who are left alone one evening in the house. Their parents have gone out. And we're told in J.M. Barrie's play that it's Wendy's last night in the nursery. In other words, she's on the cusp of becoming a woman. She's going to move out of the nursery and into the adult world. But she can't because her parents have gone out and they've left her being looked after by a dog. And this doesn't feel too great to her, really. She's a bit hacked off about that. Anyway, for the Jungians and Freudians among you, something interesting then happens. A boy with no shadow turns up, or a boy who's lost his shadow. And if any of you have spent any time in therapy, if you've got problems with your shadow, then you know that things are pretty serious here. So Peter Pan turns up, and he invites her to to join him and go and live in Neverland, where she need never grow up. And Wendy thinks this is fantastic. She can go off and she doesn't need to worry about this problem of growing up and becoming a woman anymore. She can just remain as a child in Neverland. So off she goes to Neverland, and she's there with her brothers and all the lost boys. Well, you know, she's kind of in a bit of a stuck situation here, because she ends up being mother to all of these lost boys in Neverland. So her life is completely blocked. She can't grow up, and yet she's still playing the role of mother. So the story really heads into an enclosure, into a blockage. And who's going to come and unblock it? Well, of course, pirates. And in particular, one pirate, given that the play really is about the passage of time and maturity, a pirate who is being chased by a crocodile who swallowed a watch. So we get this kind of sense of tick-tock, 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 you know, oppressing time all the way through the piece. And who is Captain Hook? Well, the traditional setting of the play, the same person who plays Captain Hook also plays Wendy's father. So in overcoming Hook, what we see kind of in the kind of psychological realm is that Wendy is overcoming this blocked situation with her father who's kind of left, and from that she's able to overcome Hook through these pirates, go back to Kensington and begin the process of becoming a woman. She realises that she needs to move on and to become a woman. And again, in the traditional telling of the play, Wendy's mother sees Peter Pan when they come back and recognises him from her own childhood. So this is a repeated cycle, something that's happened again and again. So pirates in the Peter Pan story do a work of unblocking, helping a woman to move from a blocked childhood into maturity, basically. And we see the same kind of thing happening in the Star Wars trilogy. And there's a particular moment in the, I don't know, for me, the second film, for my son, the fifth film, Empire Strikes Back. The first three are unbelievably rubbish, so we'll call it the second film, Empire Strikes Back. Sorry, Jakester, if that's, my godson is here, he's a bit of a pirate fan as well. So you've got Luke, who's hanging on to some piece of, I don't know, undercarriage of some spaceship or some superstructure, and he's been battling Darth Vader. And the moment comes where Vader says, "Luke, I am your father." And Luke goes, "No, no, 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 no." And Vader then says the following sorts of things. He says, "Together we can bring balance to the Force. And only I can complete your training." In other words, yeah, you're a pretty good kid, but actually I'm the one who's going to make you, you know, turn into a man. So Luke faces this challenge. What Vader is trying to do is to subsume Luke into his own world. And interestingly, George Lucas chose to call the two sides of this world, on one hand, the Empire, on the other hand, the Rebellion. And the people on the side of the Rebellion, you've got people like Han Solo, who's a classic pirate character. You know, he's a traitor and a bit of a, you know, footloose and everything, all the rest of it. So Vader wants Luke to join the Empire with him. And in doing so, he can bring balance to the Force, and they can basically bring conservation. You know, it's a very conservative move, that. But Luke refuses to do that. He refuses to go along with what his father says, because he knows that in doing that, that would effectively be the end of him. You know, he would become just subsumed into the Empire, and he's not prepared to do that. So he lets go and falls effectively to what Vader must see as his death, basically. But in doing that, interestingly, that opens the way for his father's redemption. In letting go and in refusing to join his father's empire, he opens the way to bring about his own father's redemption. And at the end of the, what's it called, Return of the Jedi, what you see is Vader being challenged by his son's actions, and he then says, okay, you know, and he takes off the mask, knowing that that's going to kill him, and basically they defeat the Emperor together, and is somehow redeemed. Now, Luke can't say to him, you know, I'm going to fight for your redemption. He says, look, I'm going to open up a space whereby you need to work out your own redemption. But he refuses to join with him. Now, that, for me, is a very deep and complex piratic act, whereby pirates are not working to defeat the Empire, but simply presenting a challenge to it to say, you've got to change. The pirate radio stations were not working to take over the BBC or to replace them. They were working as a challenge, and the BBC accepted that challenge. They set up Radio 1 to produce, you know, to broadcast youth music. And who were the very DJs who started out on Radio 1? The very same pirate DJs who were the previous day were working on the boats. So what the pirates did was to basically renew the orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that had become deadened. They presented a challenge to it and allowed that challenge to bring a renewal of that deadened orthodoxy. And that's exactly what you see going on with Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader as well. Now, the title of the talk, which we'll finally get to now, is really about this idea of the tragedy of the prodigal son. Because I want to tell a dark version of that story. And I'm very, very familiar with the very light version, the beautiful Henri Nguyen version of the beautiful journey of the prodigal son away from the father and, you know, this return and this moment of great grace and redemption and forgiveness. And I'm not going to say that's all wrong, okay? These are parables. They sustain multiple tellings, and that's the fantastic thing about them. But I want to retell this from a dark version, where the story is essentially, I think, something of a tragedy. Luke begins his telling in the Gospel, there was a man. And that's quite interesting, actually, because he's obviously writing his parable from the perspective of the father. There was a man who had had two sons. The story of the prodigal son does not start, there was a young guy who had an older brother and a father. It's told from the perspective of the father. But he could have told it from the other perspective. There was a young man. He chooses not to. Perhaps it's, you know, unfair to read too much into that, other than to say that, you know, we know that history is written from the point of view of the powerful. So the light version of the story is the story that the father is bound to tell. But I wondered what version of the story the son might tell if it was told from his version. Here is a young son who knew that there was a wider world outside the safe and comfortable empire that his father had built. So he approached his father and asked for his share of the inheritance. And he knew that, you know, that would be a dagger to his father's heart. But, you know, the property his father had built up would have to be split prematurely, potentially forcing his father and his older brother to live more modestly. It doesn't really carry any mention of his intentions when he asked for the inheritance, but sometime later, he got together all his money, and perhaps his father thought he was going off to invest it, to be an entrepreneur, you know, to go and join Alan Sugar or something. The economics of the parable are complex, and I think they do sustain the possibility that actually there's a complex economics going on here. In terms of the context of these parables, one of the parables that follows it is the parable of the shrewd manager, which you don't hear preached on very often. And Jesus' words at the end of that parable are this: I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when that wealth is gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. What the hell? I mean, isn't that perhaps what the young son is doing? He's going off, he's using his worldly wealth to gain friends, so that when it's gone, he'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. We'll see. The economics in these parables are not straightforward. They don't always carry convenient moral platitudes. So, we might imagine that, you know, the young son is living this comfortable life in the walled compound that his father has built. And actually, he's, you know, kind of a bit opposed to what his father's doing. His father's perhaps using slave labor, sweatshops, class discipline. And we can imagine him looking at his own future. His father and older brother have worked so hard, and there's a kind of deadness in their eyes. He didn't want to die that way. He wanted to get out. So he went away, and he celebrated in style, spending wildly and generously, sharing out the money that had previously been, you know, gathering cobwebs almost, letting it go with an extravagant potlatch. And, you know, the father says that his son wasted it in wild living. Well, you know, isn't it what every student does when they go off to university? I mean, is it so bad? You know, he had a few wild parties. Come on, you know. He took Jesus' words to heart. He used his worldly wealth to find friends. And I don't know if any of you've seen the film Into the Wild, true story about the guy Christopher McCandless, who took his inheritance money and just blew it. He gave it all away. Ended up living in Alaska on this bus, trying to find out a more, you know, wild and free life. Well, you know, if the young son hadn't sought out a real life, it soon came to find him. You know, famine struck, and the friends that he had bought, they disappeared. Soon he was left with nothing, and this was hardship like he had never known. He initially resisted the urge to go back to the dead comfort under which he'd lived with his father. He hired himself out and he tried to get on with some honest labour. It was pretty crappy work, working with the animals that his father had always despised, and he was constantly hungry. He'd never even known hunger before, really. He sat for a while in the animal feeder, considering eating the pods that the pigs had to fatten them up for some wealthy bastard who still ate well. It was too much, too soon for him. In an area of famine, no one had anything, and certainly nothing to share with him, nor did he deserve what they had. So rather than be an extra burden, he came up with a compromise. He would never live freely off his father's riches again, but he could return as a servant. This way he could rebuild his strength and do so with honest labor. More than that, he could show his father, perhaps, the error of his ways, tell him about the hungry people dying not so far away, and turn his father's heart to compassion for them. So the son returned home, tired, thirsty, and splintered. But he could only speak with half a heart, and the ideas that had felt so clear and sharp, far from home, now felt confused and timid. His father refused his pleas to have him work. He gave him a warm robe to put on, which, if a little heavy on his thinned frame, felt sumptuously comfortable. He was given again the family signet ring, which invested him with an odd feeling of pride and power. He was someone again, with a strange, alluring sense of power. This didn't seem the time or place to challenge his father and persuade him to widen the radius of his generosity. So he settled back into his old ways, accepted his old seat at the large table, loaded with dinner. "I was alive," the young man said to himself, as he sat listening to his father toasting his return. "But now I am dead again." The father was too strong. Both the brothers would become like him. From the point of view of the pirate, this story is a tragedy. Why? Because nothing changes. The son leaves, the son comes back. The father's empire retains its power and influence and its sense of enclosure. In the previous two parables, you get the parable of the lost coin. You know, the woman there sweeps the entire house clean to find this coin. The parable of the lost sheep. The shepherd leaves 99 sheep and goes far away to try and find the one. In the parable of the prodigal son, doesn't really go out looking for him. There's a sense of enclosure here. Now, Luke was writing as a Greek. And as a Greek of that time, he must have known the story of the Odyssey. Everyone would have known the story of the Odyssey, the greatest, you know, oral tradition story that had been told. Now, I think there's a very interesting parallel with the story of the prodigal son. A quick outline of the story of the Odyssey is this. Odysseus has been away fighting in Troy, started because of some disagreement between some gods over who was most beautiful. It's a long story, and I'm sure you can go and read it, and perhaps you have. But suffice to say, after the war, Odysseus has really annoyed one of the gods and is prevented from getting back home to Ithaca. And along the way, he's sidelined by beautiful women and fights. And there's basically the Odyssey, you know, beautiful women keep him from going back home. Meanwhile, his son, Telemachus, which in Greek means far from war. Even by his name, he is a different character to his father, Odysseus. And he's urged Telemachus by the goddess of reason, Athena, to go in search of his father. Well, he does go in search for him. And he sails off and looks for him and looks for him and looks for him. And where does he find him? Well, strangely, he finds him holed up with a pig herder on Ithaca. The question is this then, what's been stopping Odysseus from going home? Odysseus wants to believe that it's to do with these big other things. The gods are battling and these kind of crazy sirens are stopping me getting home. But perhaps actually. There's an internal blockage, because he is already home. He is already on Ithaca. It's just he won't make that last part of the journey. He can't take that step. And the reason he gives for it is because of the gods are stopping him. And this is where Telemachus comes in. By challenging his father, he gives him the opportunity to step up and to come home, to experience the fact that he is already home. Nothing is stopping him, and he can simply make that last part of the journey. So in comparing the story of the prodigal son and the Odyssey, in both stories we have a son who goes on a journey. But it's only in the Odyssey we see that the son has actually helped his father to change. Telemachus, far from war, helps his father to get over this blockage, his obsession with the big other and the control that has over him, and brings him home. Whereas in my dark reading of the prodigal son, the father doesn't move one bit. He remains the emperor, and his son's attempts at freedom are curtailed. Now you could ask, what makes the Odyssey a success and the prodigal son a failure? Now interestingly, it perhaps is because there is not a single mention of women in the prodigal son. It is an exclusively male parable. Athena, the goddess, brings about some change. She is the voice of reason in the story of the Odyssey, and Penelope, Odysseus's wife, is the powerful woman at home in Ithaca resisting the suitors. And perhaps this is noteworthy, because it's a church that celebrated this exclusively masculine parable with a highly conservative message that still excludes women from positions of authority and leadership. And I say, it does so at its peril. It does so at its peril. Now, I think the most interesting parallel between the stories is the point at which the narrative turns in both of them. In both stories, the nadir, the bottoming out, the lowest point of the story, the thing in which things begin to turn home, both happen among animals, in an animal feeder, in a manger. And it seems impossible that Jesus, or Luke's interpretation of him, didn't mean this to be significant. So how can we read Jesus' ministry, which also began among animals, in the light of this pirate archetype that we've established? Well, Jesus comes to find a religion that is totally blocked and enclosed. In what he sees in the temple, he experiences the total enclosure of religious practice. It has been privatized, removed from the commons, fenced off by the powerful, by those who have become rich gatekeepers. And Jesus' act of turning over the tables in the temple is fully in the tradition of beating the bounds, clearing away the material fences and enclosures that stopped people gaining free access to the place of the commons. The temple was meant to be a place of the commons. But there's a deeper story here too. Jesus leaves the riches of heaven, the comfort, the honor, and privilege of a son, for a far-off land. He breaks out of the kingdom of heaven and lives among the dirty, the marginalized, the hungry, the extremely dodgy. So much so that he, like the prodigal son, is accused of being a drunkard, of living an abundant life amongst the sinful. He too arrives in a manger among animals, and he too has to make his decision. Will he do as the prodigal did? Give up and return home, leaving things unchanged? Well, he is tempted to, but refuses. Instead, he throws himself into staying and doing what he can to help. And when he is hungry and thirsty, he doesn't head home to the comforts of his heavenly place. He remains committed to these people, to us, to the very last. And he dies doing so. He dies refusing to take the easy way out and go home. And his dying words are these: a question, a mystery, and a challenge, which perhaps deserve being read in a slightly different intonation. Father, Why have you forsaken me? Why have you forsaken me? This isn't a question of desperation, but why did you do it? Why couldn't you handle this? These words rise to the sterile, comfortable, fenced compound of heaven and make the Father very uncomfortable. And so he too does the most brave thing. He rises up from the comfort of heaven, the ease and riches of the Holy of Holies, rips the curtain and leaves to join us. And in doing so, in one swoop, he destroys the empire of religion, the power and the structures and the riches and the gatekeepers and the petty priests and the laws, and returns heaven to the commons. Now, people will keep on trying to build those walls back up and will try to become gatekeepers and try to become rich and try to put their prodigious sons and daughters on guilt trips and try to subsume their lives in work to support their petty empires. But I say, F them. You may substitute expletive. Because the message of the pirate gospel is this: a very Christian unity has already taken place. The work that pirates do has always been massively important, fighting against alienation and enclosure of our labour and our materials. But beyond the battle to create a more just economics in the privatised and terribly enclosed West, what we truly need pirates to do is to help us to claim a more radical notion of ourselves. And this is where Odysseus and Jesus, our pirates of the divine, if you will, our pirates of the inner self, are so important. Because with a merry cry and in rowdy, shanty voice, they go beyond what Marx did in terms of breaking open materialism and consumerism, and they rise up in dangerous liberty to expose the myth of our most basic separation, that we are already whole. We are already home, and we are already good. Thank you.
So I would just like to ask if you have any ideas about how to deal with the commodification of piracy. So that's, to me, the great tragedy of piracy is that those same pirates would or their tradition would be commodified into serving the crown. And I see similar things happening today. And so if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, this happens. I mean, I've scattered through the book various pictures of pirate things. The first one of which is a pair of child's pirate underpants, £3.49. The important thing is to understand, I think, that the process of understanding what that Jolly Roger means, so that whenever you see it, whenever you see that pirate motif, you can begin to think about why is that there and what does it really signify? And I talk about this much more in the book, but as a very kind of quick thing, the Jolly Roger was not there to frighten people into saying, we're going to kill you. It's much more subversive than that. What the Jolly Roger says is, we are the dead. And there is nothing more frightening than those who you have alienated, thrown out, totally excluded, and cast off as useless, worthless people coming back to you and saying, we are the dead, and yet we live still. And that's why the crucifix is still a potent pirate symbol. Because who are we? We are the dead. Paul talks you know, of himself as Christians being the filthiest, the lowest of the low, and yet we live still. And that is hugely, hugely challenging and, yeah, exciting for those who are wanting to live that pirate Christian life. And yet you will see the pirate motif all over baby bottles and comforters and baby grows and things. Why? Well, I think it's because we are helping them towards that step of independence, that step of individuation. So the reason why pirate parties, I'm glad for my son to go to them, is because it's beginning to inform him of the language of rebellion and of healthy rebellion against me, which he is going to have to do. And I'm going to have to welcome that at some point. Not, you know, to disappear, but so that the orthodoxy can be renewed, and we need to allow people to do that. So that's why I hope always that the pirate motif will remain that dangerous way. What's the time? We've got time for a couple more questions, please. Yeah.
I can think of two biblical stories that end the same way as the prodigal son. The parable of the vineyard and the story of Jonah. And I know in both of them they end where, Jonah's jealous at God for showing mercy to Nineveh. And one of the laborers in the vineyard is jealous at the vineyard owner for sharing his wealth as he pleases. I wanted to ask, is there anything wrong with thinking of the father at the end of the prodigal son story as being the rebel and the pirate, because he drew out all the evil in his household when he called the brother who stayed home to deal with the fact that he was jealous of mercy?
That's not a reading I've explored yet, and to do it on the spot, I would have to think carefully about it, but I think that's going to be worth doing. And one of the things that I think is always worth doing is, whenever you come to a parable, is think, okay, how can I rethink who the people are in this? And for me, it was the rethinking of, well, what if we say the prodigal son is not us as fallen people, but what if the prodigal son is Jesus himself? How does that change it? So again, you know, to do that with other parables and to think about, yes, what about if the father is the rebel and has allowed that to happen, there may be some good things in that. Yeah. Got time for another couple of quick questions, then I need to go and do things in the bookshop on time, because I don't want to mess up their timing. Thank you.
My father always brought me up to kind of say, you know, if you want to change the system, join the system. And I've kind of questioned that ever since, really. But and you talk about the kind of renewal of orthodoxy and, you know, your example of the pirate stations, you know, those DJs became the DJs of Radio 1. And I guess my question is, you know, what are you advocating as followers of the Christ that actually we, we're trying to challenge the system, the empire, the state, to bring about revolution and then join it? Or actually are we to remain in that place of protagonists and exiles?
I think that's going to be different roles at different stages of life. And at some point you need to do various things. Part of me wants to say, join the church and destroy it from within. And as a very serious point, which you can argue with me about over a bit later if you want to, but which I was arguing with a friend yesterday, is I honestly believe that if we are serious about a religion that talks about death and resurrection, we have to work more carefully to allow the church to die and to really die, and that will be a good thing. And I'm sorry if, you know, the cathedrals and all these buildings are lovely, but actually we need to be more serious about something that is more profound and radical. And for me, the church needs to die, and I'm not going to rush forward to speak yet of its resurrection, because it hasn't died enough yet. I think I probably need to leave it on that, and I'm really sorry, but do come and grab me later. So I've got Some of these, and then somewhere some nice hand-printed hardbacks you can get in the shop now for a bit. You can come and buy that. And yeah, can have a beer later too. So thanks so much. Cheers.